Session number 20895, Reel 7.
John Deere, Reel 7.
I should mention one incident that I'd forgotten in this long period of waiting. I had been called for... I'd been told by the CO that D Troop was in trouble. He had no radio contact with them, but I was to send a party across to reinforce the section from E Troop that was holding a bridgehead on Belle Isle, and also attempt to get a rope across so that the ferry system could begin and we could reinforce the Belle Isle in strength. I found that there were only two of the assault boats on my side of the river. I put Bob Aylett, Troop Sergeant Major, with a subsection in one and told him to go across and reinforce the bridgehead. And the other craft, I took some of the Royal Marine engineers who were concerned with operating the ferry, with a few men from B Troop, and we started off trying to get a rope across. It was, in fact, a hopeless task. We tried three times and never got beyond the middle of the river. Trailing the long rope behind us was, of course, a dreadful handicap. And at one stage, I don't know whether the bridgehead was under attack, but I know Bren guns from the our own people on the riverbank were firing across over our heads at the enemy on Belle Isle. After the third attempt, I returned in the one remaining assault craft, reported to the CO that it was an impossible task, returned to my own troop, wet, cold, and very despondent at the failure to get a rope across. It was after this that there was a long period of waiting and waiting and waiting and getting colder and colder. I was rejoined by Bob Aylett and his section, and then told, after a long pause, I heard someone calling for me, saying that the CO wanted to see me. I went back to the CO, hoping that we were being told that we could return to our billet. But he said that Ian Beadle had taken a patrol across to Belle Isle, and that he had returned without any interference from the enemy. There was now a sergeant from D Troop, Sergeant Fenwick, who had called across to say that he had some wounded with him, and I was therefore to go across and bring Fenwick and the wounded men back. I returned to my troop and said that I wanted half a dozen volunteers to go across the river with me, and I grabbed at the first five or six who moved forward in the darkness. One, of course, was the redoubtable Bob Aylett. There were two sergeants, Jack Sinclair and Johnny Bastable, and Marine Ogle, the Piat man who had to be persuaded to leave his Piat behind, and Marine Denny. We went down to get ourselves a boat and set off for the other side. Fenwick we saw on the island waving to us, and we managed to paddle our way reasonably happily up to where he was standing by the riverbank. I told Jack Sinclair to hold the boat, and when I say hold the boat, make sure he didn't let it go. I sent Bob Aylett with the others and with Jock Fenwick up along the riverbank to where Jock Fenwick said the wounded man was lying, and took Denny with me up to the riverbank to provide some form of protection. Shortly after the party heading up for the wounded man moved off. There was a burst of machine gun fire, which was aimed at Jack Sinclair, as far as I could see, but he was remaining standing up and did not appear to be injured. Nothing much happened where Denny and I were in position, and as we saw the party carrying someone back, he and I rejoined rejoined Jack Sinclair at the boat, and the party appeared safely with the wounded man. Jack Sinclair moved off to help them lift the wounded man onto the boat, and Ogle joined me in hanging on to the boat. At this point, the enemy machine gun opened up again, and I remember looking in the direction of the fire, and I could see the flames of the machine gun, and curiously enough, the helmet of the man who was firing at it. The fire was very accurate, and I did see sparks fly at my feet, where a bullet had obviously hit a pebble on the riverbank. There had been some argument, or rather discussion, between Bob Aylett and Jack Sinclair and Jock Fenwick. Jock apparently felt that he ought to return, having been allowed out by the Germans to look for wounded. But the enemy fire, apart from anything else, I think persuaded Jock, rightly, to get in the boat with us. Everybody in the boat, and I told Ogle to get in the boat, which he did rather clumsily, and I then, with everybody else on board, gave a final shove and got in myself. The German was still firing, but he had obviously altered his aim, because the firing initially was into Belle Isle rather than us, but he started firing at us again as he saw the boat obviously in the river. Ogle was not paddling. Everybody else was paddling like mad. So rather tersely, I inquired, not very politely, of Ogle, why the hell he wasn't paddling. And a rather aggrieved Ogle said, "I can't, sir. I've been hit in both arms." Unfortunately, I never saw Ogle again after we landed and was unable to apologise for my bad behaviour. I was irritated by the fact that the Germans were firing at us in midstream without any response from our own people. So I yelled at Peter Riley, invoking the deity, and they did then open up. We landed, taken by the current, way below stream, but we did get ashore, and someone found a gate or something handy, which we used as a stretcher, and we returned to the commander position with long distance machine gun fire from Germans whistling overhead. That was the end of that operation. I should perhaps mention here that my friend Peter Winston had been killed on Belle Isle. The rest of the time, for the next two or three weeks, we were in various positions in the same area, and we were occupied by some patrolling. The German positions were some distance away. We were told that there was what was known as the switch line of the Siegfried Line, some 3 or 4 miles away. We were never near it, but we did do some night patrols in the ground between us and the Germans, and they did some patrols, but this had no action as far as Beetroot was concerned. On the 19th of February, we were relieved by the United States 9th Army troops, and I used this occasion to catch a carbine from the Americans. And I use this for the rest of the campaign. We, after being relieved, we were sent to take up a position along the Maas near Wielingsbeek. But we were not there very long, as on the 27th of February, we and a 6th commander were moved to Afferden to take part in the final stage of the 1st Canadian Army's operation to clear the enemy between the Maas and the Rhine. This was really of little interest, except that we, B Troop and I think E Troop, did patrols on tanks from a Guards Armour Brigade regiment. I had no contact with the enemy. A few days after we'd been in the area of Afferden, where we had relieved the 52nd Division Reconnaissance Regiment, we set out on a night march, which was quite the most unpleasant I remember doing. There was no enemy fire, but it was a long, long move with the engineers in front of us clearing mines away, and I believe they took some casualties doing this, but we ourselves did not suffer in any way. We eventually ended up at Well, on the opposite side of the Maas from 46 Commando, so we were well received. They provided us with some food and put out some patrols in front of us while we rested. On the 8th of March, we moved off to Venray for a period of rest, and where also we trained in buffaloes and weasels and storm boats, ready for the next big operation, the crossing of the Rhine. And this time, small numbers at a time were sent on 48 hours leave to Brussels, but I don't think I'll need to provide any report on that. About the 20th of March, we left Venray and moved up closer to the Rhine, where, rather reminiscent of D-Day, we were occupied in being briefed for the operation. The brigade's task was to capture the important communication centre of Wesel. And to do this, the brigadier was going to land the brigade about 2 or 3 miles downstream from Wesel. 46 Commando would have the task of obtaining the bridgehead, and then 6 Commando, followed by 4, 5, and 3 Commando, would advance on Wesel. Once in Wesel, 4, 5 Commando would move to the northern outskirts and occupy a factory, with the other units taking up defensive positions and mopping up in Wesel itself. The thing, the particular interest about Wesel as an operation is that it was to be attacked shortly before our ground attack by a heavy force of Lancasters. And in fact, while we were already being briefed on this operation, arrangements were made for an earlier bombing of Wesel by light bombers in daylight. And I remember watching this attack go in sometime in the afternoon of 23rd of March. There was a tremendous artillery program for the crossing, and this began somewhere around, I suppose, 7 o'clock. I think we were due to cross at about 10 o'clock that evening in buffaloes. Incidentally, at one of our briefings, the brigade commander had said that Hannibal had crossed the Alps on elephants, and we could tell our grandchildren we had crossed the Rhine on buffaloes. We would cross in buffaloes. 46 commando crossed the Buffaloes, 6 commando were to cross in the storm boats, horrible little outboard boats which we'd found in our training at Venray were very unreliable. However, all was set by the evening of 23rd of March. We were in position at in our waiting positions on by the banks of the Rhine. 46 commando moved across. The artillery fire were making a tremendous noise as they fired on the Germans, and for a short time one almost felt sorry for the people at the receiving end. And then the Buffaloes came back, and we got into our Buffalo and proceeded without any incident across the Rhine. One of the Buffaloes in the first attack had been hit, I think probably by our supporting fire, but it was in flames, but our crossing was without incident, apart from the noise and and also the bombing, which by this time had started. We formed up in the bridgehead, which 46 commando had taken. I had a short period of concern because 46 commando who crossed in these wretched storm boats were late, and if they didn't appear, because I was leading the commando, I feared that I would have to lead the whole brigade, and I had not studied the proposed route in the right amount of detail. However, the 6th Commando did arrive, and I saw chum of mine, Eddie Leppard, who was going to be the leading troop commander in 6th Commando, go past me, and I was very relieved to see him. We set off in the approach march to Wesel with little of interest, as far as I can remember. We passed through a German anti-aircraft battery position, which 6th Commando had dealt with. It was extraordinary walking through the German guns, the 88 millimeters, without any sign of any Germans around, and eventually arrived at Wesel itself, which in effect meant that one walked into what seemed to be a furnace. There were flames everywhere, and one could feel the heat from the flames. We couldn't really appreciate that time just what had been done to Wesel, but when we started our preparing for our advance, we found that the route that I had studied on the air map, air photograph of Wesel, was quite useless because there were no houses standing. I had led the troop clear of the 6th Commando position. And halted them for a short while, as ordered, while the remainder of the commando formed up behind me. My radio, once again, was not working, so I took Jock Irvin back along the line of the commando to find the CO to get the order to advance. Unknown to me, he had followed the line forward to me and arrived at my troop headquarters while I was searching for him. And the headquarters was attacked by two Germans with the Panzerfaust. The CO was wounded, and four men in my support section were all wounded. As soon as I'd heard the sound of the Panzerfaust and the small arms fire from my troop, who, as they killed the Germans, I hurried back to find this in position, was told by the CO to start advance. Well, we made our way, by guess and by God, if I may say so, unable to follow anything that was set out in the air photographs, and eventually found our objective, the factory, which was on the outskirts by the railway lines at Wesel, without any further incident. We took up a position in the factory, which we had been told manufactured barbed wire, but it seemed that most of the things they managed there were the porcelain lavatory seats, and we used our pistols and rifles after the battle was over, trying to find how well these lavatory seats would stand up to small arms fire. The rest of the night was fairly quiet once the bombing was over. Oh, sorry, the bombing had ceased once the occupation of Wesel took place, as far as the commander was concerned. And I don't think any other troops had any interference with taking up the positions. The factory we were in had a concrete floor, which meant we were unable to dig in. But we had one or two positions outside, but within the factory position, which was the main part of the B troop position, we had to make holes in the walls to give us ourselves firing positions. And fortunately, there were sheets of steel, I imagine, of metal around in the factory, which we used to help give us some sort of cover. The next morning, the airborne attack by the United States Airborne Division and 6th Airborne Division was, I think, due to take place at around about 10 a.m. And we had been warned that from that time onwards, until I think about noon, we were unable to be provided with any artillery support. We began to see the airborne arriving, people coming down in parachute, but mostly aircraft, some in distress, on fire, Dakotas, and presumably some glider troops. But we did see the airborne forces landing. At about this time, the enemy began an attack. This was aimed mainly on E Troop, which was on my left flank, but there was some movement immediately to our front, which was sufficient to keep us interested, though there never looked like being any attack against B Troop position. E Troop was having problems because the attack was supported by either a tank or a self-propelled gun of some kind, and they were taking casualties. We heard on the radio the CO give E Troop position permission to withdraw if he wished to do so, and this led to me and Peter Riley, who was then commanding D Troop on my right, a conversation which got a bit light-hearted, and I told him he would be all right with B Troop looking after him, which led to Commander Headquarters cutting in and telling us to get off the air. However, Ian Beadle, as one might expect, stood fast, and then the time came when we could call for artillery support, and that was brought down, which drove the enemy away, including the SP guns, from B Troop. The rest of our time in the factory, which I think lasted about 2 or 3 days, was mainly spent under fire from the Germans for the first 24-36 hours. Some of this was ordinary artillery fire. Some of it was either tank or anti-tank gun and an 88mm firing in a ground position. And I found that being under shell fire in a house was much more unpleasant than being under shell fire in a slit trench. The factory we were in had a lot of steel girders, and the shells that burst then hit steel girders and buzzed around. They may have been moving more slowly, but they were making a lot of noise, and they did cause some damage, and we had a number of casualties. One other point of interest, there was at one stage, my attention was called to some movement way off to the left flank, where we could see some figures dashing down the railway line and hear bursts of fire every so often. And eventually we could make out that this was an American force. In fact, it turned out to be an American patrol of some half dozen men. And the bursts of fire, when we initially thought they were very courageous, their advance down the railway line continually coming under fire, was in fact, we saw that they were firing themselves at the ground 100 yards ahead, and then dashing along in, afterwards. And they eventually joined up with us, and so we were to have a link up with the airborne, the US airborne forces. Otherwise, Weser was unpleasant. It was full of dust. The engineers were mostly, I think, American. Engineers were busy making making roads through the rubble. Weser really was just a mass of rubble. Anyway, on the 27th of March, we left Weser, moving initially on foot. We apparently were in reserve. Though some various people passed us, including RAF ground crews, which didn't please us. The men had used barrows, one or two had prams to put their gear on, and eventually we were picked up by troop-carrying vehicles. We arrived at a place called Greven, about 10 miles north of Munster, on the 1st of April. And just soon after arriving in the area, I was called for by the CO, who was now Alfred Blake, Nicol Gray having been evacuated after 24 hours after we arrived at Weser. And Alf Blake had been the second in command, was now acting as CO. And he was. I was told that the BBC had reported that Munster had been captured, and this conflicted with information available to brigade headquarters, but I was to proceed in the direction of Munster to find out, to clarify the situation. Well, this sounded rather fun. I was given another jeep in addition to the troop jeep, and I think I took about a dozen people, mostly armed with Bren guns, on the two jeeps, and off we set. For some reason I cannot recall now, I decided not to go straight from Greven into Munster, but to drive south and then approach Munster from the west. This was a good thing, but I had no idea why I decided this at the time. Off we sallied, all of us rather happy to be travelling round in this free and easy style. We came to a village at which I was going to turn left to head for Munster. There were a lot of tanks there, which I saw from the insignia were Guards Armour Brigade tanks, and a lot of American parachutists in the village centre. And we gave them a wave and drove through and then to the outskirts of Greven, where I passed some parachutists lying by the side of the road. And as I drove past, I thought they looked a little surprised at seeing us driving past. So I stopped my jeep and the one behind me and went back, reversed or turned around and went back and asked the parachutists what they were doing there. They said, oh, well, they were waiting for orders to move into Munster. So I then went back to the centre of the village and eventually made my way to the Guards Armoured Brigade headquarters, saw the brigadier, explained what I was after, and was informed that indeed the tanks and the parachutists were waiting to advance on Munster. Munster had not been taken by British forces. And I remember it was April Fool's Day, somebody in the jeep making a comment that, you know, this could only happen on April Fool's Day, and somebody else making a rude comment about the BBC. Back we went to our own position, own commander, and passed the news on that Munster had not been taken, but would be shortly. Oddly enough, only about 2 years ago, I met one of the Guards Armoured Brigade officers who told me, didn't remember me appearing, hadn't seen me, but he remembered this occasion, and his tank had been the first to lead the advance into Munster. David Scott Barrett. Can't remember where quite when we left Greven, but I think we may have stayed there until the 3rd of April, when early in the morning, we set out, the CO with the his O group, that is the troop commander in each case, and a small party, I think we were in about four or five jeeps, to do a reconnaissance for an attack on Osnabrück. And we...